we are now moving to your questions and our answers. Let's start with Michael Hutner. I think you are the most senior person in the room because you've been following AXA for the longest. There you go.
Thank you so much. So A, congratulations. These are record numbers. B, I only have two questions. So I detect, but I may be wrong, you've just been skiing. And so my question is, 2023 and beyond, you know, from when you were skiing and, you know, waiting for the queue or whatever it is, what does it look like, you know, the next plan? And then the second on cash. I love cash. I think it's fantastic. 5.5 billion is a real, is an amazing number. You alluded to lots of possibilities, including AXA XL. Could you give us a few more hints about 2023? And that's it.
Good. Thank you, Michael. So just to repeat your questions, the first one was on what the next plan could look like, and second one on cash. I'll talk about the next plan, and Alban, if you could talk about some more highlights on cash. So as I mentioned earlier, we are now in the last year of the Driving Progress 2023, so full attention is really to get this plan to a good ending. You've seen that on two KPIs we have already exceeded the good ending. On the others, we need to make sure that we are staying in the line, but you see from all three of us and also my colleagues at the table over there that we are very confident to achieve that plan. Nevertheless, we want to think ahead. And so what I said earlier is that with this, with the end of this plan, very significant transformation of AXA comes to an end, because for those of you who have not been in the room for as long as Michael has been in the room, after the financial crisis, we were 80% in financial risk. At the end of this year, hopefully, we'll be less than 15% in financial risk, keeping the same revenue of 100 billion. So this gives us a new, a focused, a more simple platform that is much more cash generation rating as our old business mix used to be. And the focus of the next plan will clearly be around how do we make this platform grow. We don't want to, you know, think about this next year, so because in about a year's time we will publish that plan. We are starting to think about this already now. Those three gentlemen that sit over there, we are in regular discussions already with what are their growth initiatives, how can we already fund them now, so that we basically flow into a new plan which is very much focused on growth. Obviously, notwithstanding that the question around expense discipline and the success that we have had on technical discipline will continue. Alban, on cash.
So on cash, there are a few items to take into account. First, the transformation of AXA SA into a reinsurer. We had said that we would have 1 billion by the end of 23. We had 300 million in 22, so that gives you an idea of what's left to be done in 23. Then on usual remittance, and you know that usual remittance includes part of that benefit because that transformation allows to reduce the capitalization of some entities. But the usual remittance should grow more than our earnings. That's very much in line with what Frédéric said. And you also have some in-force transactions that for which we will have the benefit also in 23. So on AXA XL, so I believe the today, the remittance ratio for AXA XL is around 60%, and it can grow in 2023. I'm looking at Scott for that, but I count on him.
Let's stay at the same table and go to Andy.
Thanks. Andy Sinclair from Bank of America. Three from me, please. Firstly, it was just on reinsurance and cat risk management. I saw there was an increase in the retentions for US hurricane and US earthquake, but on slide B27 in the appendices, I saw that the 1 in 5, 1 in 10 year scenario was unchanged on the downside, 1 in 20 barely changed. Just really wondered, how is there not more risk from hurricanes coming through in those numbers? And is that a big de-risking of the book on an underlying basis? So that's question one. Secondly is on XL. Just really wondered about ability to grow XL's exposures in 2023. Looks like exposure has still been shrinking slightly on the insurance side. Is the insurance side going to move to exposure growth in 23? And thirdly, was on holding company cash. Lovely to see a buyback, great, but I'm immediately going to push you for more. Looking at the cash that's coming from the reinsurance changes, looking from higher remittances in 23, I mean, you've got a 1 to 3 billion holdco cash target. You've got 4.5 now. Sounds like you'll be in the region of 6 billion by the end of 23. What are thoughts on that cash? And you seem to be building it faster than returning it. Thank you.
Very good. So, Frédéric, for you, the first question around reinsurance, CatNat, the retention increase. Scott, how can we make XL grow in terms of exposures and not only in terms of prices? And then, Alban, if you can talk about the question on holding cash. Maybe, Andy, around this holding cash, we are very happy about being above the 1 to 3 billion. We are in a period that is colored by a lot of uncertainty, and having a good cash position lets you sleep well at night. Frederick.
So I start on reinsurance. So as I said, we faced various challenges during the reinsurance renewals. So there was a lack of capacity for the lower tranches. With very few exceptions, we don't have holes in what we call the tower. And you should not forget on the other side of the equation that we've significantly reduced our exposures, especially in AXA XL Re. So the sum of all of this has an impact on the cat load, of course. It has an impact also on the 1 to 10 and 1 to 20 scenarios. What I can tell you is that on the 1 to 10 and 1 to 20 scenarios, the impact is not more than 6 to 7% on these scenarios.
Thank you. Scott, growth of AXA XL in 2023.
Sure. And just on the exposure for us, you have exposure a couple of different ways. One is the value increases or revenue increases of those clients. For the most part, as you know, that trails the inflation. So the inflation goes up, and then we get the value increases sort of as the counts come up for renewal. So we expect to see positive exposure growth in the lines that have values, for example, property, marine cargo, those kind of growth areas. The other lines that have exposure, such as revenue turnover, that depends on the economy and depends what's happening, but we do expect to see positive exposure growth in the renewal portfolio. Another piece of exposure that we're looking at is working closely with our colleagues at AXA GI. We're looking to grow our exposure in the middle market business, particularly in Europe, UK, and in the U.S., so that exposure for those middle market clients, we expect to see that exposure from a risk standpoint growth for XL next year.
Alban, on the cash projections.
So on cash, a few thoughts. One, all the cards on the table to determine what will be the cash at the end of the year, because we talked about the remittance. You know that we issue $1 billion net debt, and you saw the dividend and the buyback that we want to do this year. Second, we are happy to be in that position cash-wise, but fundamentally the question you're asking is the question for our board next year when we have that cash at Holdco and they determine what they want to do with it in terms of dividend, buybacks, or other. But we're happy to be...
On that $1 billion of net debt issuance, do you still want to be issuing net debt when you've got that level of cash?
So I think it's also a question of solvency. That's what we said for this plan. We might review that for the next plan, but we'll tell you about this next year.
Thank you very much.
We have the certainty that we don't want to pile up cash.
Yes.
Glad to hear it.
Peter?
Thank you very much. Yeah, Peter Elliott from Kepler Cheuvreux. Three from me, please. Yvonne, just on the minus 4 points from the reference portfolio to come, I mean, I know some of the weightings have changed and some of them have gone down, but I was struggling really to sort of get to 4 points. And I'm just wondering if you could say sort of which particular bucket it is that caused that. I mean, Japanese govies maybe went down a bit, but I'm struggling to see what should impact you more than others in the changes that we've seen there. The second question was on the life technical margin. Great result, obviously. And take your comments on the French changes. If I look, actually, I mean, every region pretty much has come up with a record year on that front. And it was also sort of very much sort of H2 loaded. So if we look at the H2 run rate, I think it was like 1.7 billion. I'm just wondering if there's anything else we should normalize in that or how you would look at that on an ongoing basis. And then maybe the third one, share buyback. Thomas, your comments at the start made it sound like it was a sort of an annual decision on the discretionary. I guess in the past we've seen announcements that Q2 or Q3 are a little bit more ad hoc. So it sounded like maybe that was a little bit of a change in approach. I was just wondering if you could clarify how we should think of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. So I suggest, Alban, you take the first two questions around the reference portfolio and the life technical margin, and I'll answer Peter's question on the share buyback.
So on the first question on the reference portfolio, I can't see why we would be more affected than competitors, because the reason for that is simply when spread widens, as you know, you take the reference portfolio spread and you sort of apply it to determine your risk adjustment. So the change in weights in the reference portfolio just means that overall that spread widening for the reference portfolio will be smaller, and therefore there would be less contracyclical. But that applies to everyone. That's not us in particular. We are just saying that ahead so that you can determine what our solvency would be at the end of Q1. On the life technical margin, I signaled that in France there was a one-off coming from a change in actuarial assumptions, but the rest, and in particular the good growth that we had in Japan with protection with unit linked, that's stable.
It's the second time that we've seen a little bit of, or that you flagged a little bit of an impact on the solvency ratio from the reference portfolio. And I think the first time a few years ago it came from Japan. Others haven't done that, so I just wondered. But maybe something for offline or nothing more you can say.
And it's not at all specific to Japan. It's really our bond portfolio and the reference portfolio, which is more European than Asian or whatever.
On the share buybacks. So our policy is relatively clear. The board has set out to say, look, AXA wants to deliver an attractive return to shareholders, which is benchmarked also with competition. The board has determined this year that 70% is the number that they want to go for, and you've seen the 10% increase in dividend and the 1.1 billion share buyback. The board takes once a year a look on this and looks at what are we doing with the available excess cash in order to get to that attractive capital return to shareholders. So the decision has been taken in February this year, and we will look at this again next year when the new round is starting. Obviously, The share buybacks that are there to offset dilution of earnings because we have sold a portfolio or a company, that's a different story. I mentioned earlier the German life book. There the policy was always when we sell something and it has been announced at the point of closing, there is a share buyback happening in order to offset the dilution, which is still the case for the open case of the German life portfolio. If it was to close this year, and that's very much dependent on regulatory approval, then the dotted box that you saw on the slide is exactly that discretionary share buyback of the 300 million, should it be the 300 million at closing. But it's an annual decision.
Thanks very much.
So let's move here to Dominic, and we'll go to the back later on.
Sorry, hi. Dominic Marney, BNP Paribas Exane. Thanks for the questions. Three for me as well, please. First, just wondering if you... Very helpful to hear that the lapse experience is perfectly normal during full year 22. Could you just give us an update whether there's any change so far in full year 23, or is the lapse experience continuing to be sort of normal? Second was just on life investment margins, which I think came in at 63 basis points for the year, which clearly is good in your, and in your range. It was quite a lot higher at half year. I think it was 70 bips at half year. Just wondering whether there's something we need to think about for our forward-looking numbers, what sort of run rate it is, whether something happened in H2. And then third question, you're going to call me greedy, but just on the cash topic, if I look at the 5.2 organic remits and I strip out the billion of holdco costs, I think that's about a 60% payout on full year 21 earnings. I'm trying to work out whether that's you folks being conservative and thinking you're well ahead of your targets anyway, or whether there might be a factor holding back cash remittance, and if there is, whether you could share it with us. Thank you.
Very good. So I suggest that because Alban has already spoken about the lapse experience, let's zoom into a market. And this topic often comes up in France, so I would like to ask Patrick to talk about the beginning of this year and his lapse experience or non-lapse experience, I suggest, in France. And then, Alban, if you could take the second question around the life margin, is it sustainable? And Frederic, if you could take the third one around the cash development and upstreaming to the entities, since you've spoken about it before. Patrick.
Yeah, thank you for the question, and good afternoon, everyone. So in terms first of TOCF, it is stable in France, and I think what is important to notice is that the diversified savings strategy that we're pursuing is working quite well, to the extent that we have a positive TOCF of 2.2 billion on unit linked. We have a positive TOCF of 1.8 billion on Euro Croissance, which is our capital light GA, and minus 5.1 on the general accounts. Now, if you look overall at the GA lapse, it is stable in our proprietary networks. And that's a combination of many things, even given the raise on the Livret A, which is now at 3%. First, it's, I'd say, the expertise of our very specialized agent network, their proximity, the long tenure they have with their customers. The second, there are some parts of the product in terms of tax benefits on inheritance benefits that I would say contains a lot that potential lapse effect in France. So we do not expect lapses to increase also in 2023.
Alban, on the life investment margin.
So no, you're absolutely right. It was higher at half year, but there is seasonality because in the first half, that's when you get the dividends on the equities. And there was also more distribution from funds, and in particular private equity fund. And you didn't have that on the second half of the year, while you had the distribution or the provision for distribution to the policyholders. That explains the difference between H1 and H2. It is. I think it's fair. Now, going forward with IFRS 17, it would be difficult to follow. But yes.
Yes, there was that as well, IFRS 17. Frederic, on cash.
On cash, Dominique. First, I'm not sure to understand your 60%, but I'll anyway give an answer. And so the remittance from our local companies today is at 73%. So if I take all my BUs, they pay 73% as a dividend, 73% of their IFRS result. We believe it will improve, as I've said. And we have especially four areas where we're working and we believe we can have improvements. The first one already mentioned is we believe we can significantly improve this remittance ratio at AXA XL already from 2023. The second one, which is more difficult to solve but on which we are working hard, is AXA Hong Kong, because AXA Hong Kong only has a 40% remittance ratio for regulatory reasons. And together with Thomas, with Albon, with all the team, we are working hard on this. We've already improved it because it was 25%, so we've moved up to 40%, and we have hope to continue to improve it. The third one is Japan, on which we've made a good job. We've progressively increased the payout in Japan to 70%. We probably have some more way to go. And the last one that Albon mentioned is Citadel. So you know that Citadel, so the reinsurance arrangement between AXA SA and the business units, first, it doesn't cover the full scope of our entities, so some of our entities are out. Belgium is out for various reasons. The European business at XL is out for various reasons. But we're going to look at this again. And the quota share is 25%. And we believe, subject, of course, to regulatory approval, but based on what we know, that we have some room to improve it, which will, again, improve the remittance ratios. I don't know if I have answered.
Andrew, and let me guess, your question will be on solvency.
No.
Oh, it's not. Bad guess.
It's a couple of questions really on reserve releases. I think you had a 1 billion PYD reserve release, and you've got 1.3 billion still above the buffer, best estimate buffer. Should we expect that to come down to the best estimate buffer over this year? And I suppose related to that, you've had such strong pricing in commercial lines and reinsurance, it would not be a surprise if you were building a bit of caution into the current year reserve setup. I mean, is there any? There's no way we can analyse that, but is there any comment you'd like to make on that? And finally, on the P&C investment income, that was up 350 million. Obviously, reinvestment rates, you're going to be continuing to reinvest at higher rates. What likely benefit are you likely to get on investment income this year in P&C?
Thank you, Andrew. So, Albon, I suggest you take all three questions. On the first one, the 1.3 billion buffer above best estimates. Second one, the question around commercial line pricing and the cushion, which covers XL but also the other geographies. And then the question around P&C investment income and the uptick from high yields.
So, on the reserve, on the buffer, the 1.3 billion GA excess reserves, unfortunately, that disappeared with IFRS 17. That's the part where we showed you, when we showed you the opening balance sheet, that was already in net assets. So that part will not go to P&L. Are we cautious in our current year? I'd say we are cautious in our current year, like we are cautious in our reserves. We want to have prudent reserves. That's even under IFRS 17, even with our best estimate, it will err on the side of caution. But there's no particular caution in addition to that for our current year. And on P&C investment income, so overall, we invested at 2.90% in 22. In December, that was 4.4% I'm not sure we'll be able to have that the whole of 23. But that gives you an idea of the additional investment income that we may have. But bear in mind that in the 350, a significant part came from inflation. So it depends on how much inflation we'll have in Europe and in Turkey. I say that because you saw probably that our yield on PNC went from 2.6 to 2.8%. If you strip out Turkey and Colombia, which are two high inflation countries, it went up from 2.4 to 2.6. The 2.6 is closer to the yield that we have, say, in Western Europe and Excel overall.
Let's go to the back to Ashik.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon. Ashik Musaddi from Morgan Stanley. Just have a couple of questions, actually. I mean, first of all, on solvency. I mean, your solvency was pretty high at north of 220%, and those levels are pretty comfortable because your sensitivity to interest rates are still high. But falling below 210 now, if I include the 9 points hit you're flagging, so you'll be at 205 somewhat. But if interest rates fall, I mean, you can easily go below towards 190, even a bit lower. So what is your thinking around that? Is there any way to lock in interest rate benefit so that your sensitivity is reduced and we don't see any potential negative? So can something be done on that? Would be the first question. And secondly, I guess there was some mention about quota share. You have increased the quota share agreements, etc. Can you just elaborate a bit more as to where it was earlier and what has happened and how does that change the CAT exposure? Thank you.
Thank you, Ashik. So I suggest, Alban, you talk about the first question around the solvency roll forward after the technical adjustments that we have on IBOR and reference portfolio. And, Frederick, if you could go back to... Scott, okay. Let's do Scott on the quota share XL, because it's an XL-related question. Alban.
So several items. First, when you look at our solvency creation in a given year, if you look at this year, we create 23 points, but after dividend, you still have 9 points remaining. So that would offset... Well, I mean, before any potential share buyback next year, but that would offset the impact of the two regulatory changes I mentioned. That's the first point. Second point, when you look at the benefit of higher interest rates, it's 18 points, but we keep a duration gap which is low, around 0.5, but we could reduce it further and even come to the other side of the duration gap, which, as you said, would lead us to lock in those benefits. And that's something that we are thinking about. We need to find the moment when we would do that. Third, a significant part of that 18 points benefit was offset by the higher volatility in equity and interest rates. If at some point, for a given level of interest rates, just volatility comes down because that stabilizes, we would regain part or all of those 11 points. So that also needs to be kept in mind.
And I guess, Alban, we could also decide to reinstall the equity hedges, which Absolutely. Would again add solvency.
Yeah.
Scott, on the quota share?
Yeah, on the quota share. We purchase a quota share for our property business that's North America as well as Europe and Australia, Asia. And due to the improvement in our portfolio, you'll notice the 2-point improvement in the attritional loss ratio improved for AXA XL. We got significant interest in reinsurers offering more capacity for this property quota share. So we took the pricing was appropriate, so we took the advantage of buying a little more quota share. That quota share also includes CAT cover. So it includes wind, it includes earthquake. So as a result, we get a little bit of more help on the CAT side when we purchase more quota share.
Let's move to Farouk.
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much. You've mentioned in quite big font in your presentation the 70% payout ratio, and you said this is in line with our peers. Is this now a kind of a philosophy to be in line with peers on payout ratio, whatever that means in the new world? That's question one. Question two for Scott. Looking, you know, right at the back at the slide, slide B28, where you show the lines of business, I mean, you seem to have de-risked everywhere. Look at specialty, primary casualty, financial lines. It's been contraction of premium versus pricing. It's been really big. So in 2023, you're doing further XL re contraction. Are you also going to contract, apart from the quota share, are you going to, sort of from a written basis, also going to continue contracting line sizes in other areas? And the last question on higher yields in P&C. So if you could just help technically, if we move to a IFRS 17 world where you have an immediate discount rate which reflects current yields, and if you net off the impact of the inflation-linked bond benefit, is that still an immediate jump that we get in earnings because yields have gone up? I'm just curious. Thank you.
Very good. So let me quickly start with the 70%. I mean, obviously, the board of directors will always look at what is an attractive capital yield for the investor, which is this year being determined to be 70% and in the components you have seen. Again, this is something that happens on an annual basis because these things might change. The 70% are not fixed. This is this year's view. It might change next year. But I think as an approach, it's a good orientation to say, look, we want to be an attractive dividend yield. We compare ourselves to competitors, and we will engineer dividend and a potential share buyback, depending on what the board decides on a yearly basis, to a reasonable and attractive level. Scott, B28, around, will there be more contraction, yes or no?
The simple answer is there won't be more contraction. If you look at that chart, the one that stands out is the financial lines line. And what that is, that's the impact. In 2021, with the IPO SPAC marketplace in the United States at the time, we're one of the largest writers of public D&O. So we were able to take advantage of that marketplace. It was very robust, write a lot of business, but it's a one-time deal, right? You sort of write it. It was for IPO, it was for SPACs, and then it doesn't renew, right? So as a result, we took a pretty significant reduction in volume just because, you know, the market kind of froze up. There wasn't any IPO. So that volume wasn't really a risking issue. That was just, it just disappeared, right? The other pieces of the business, you'll notice that property basically held flat. So New Balance loss, we sort of flat relative to rate. Casualty, we did a little more work on some line sizing, particularly in the European casualty business, because it's starting to get impacted by some of the social inflation factors, so we kind of reduced some exposure there. But we're essentially done that work, right? So we're on the insurance side. On the reinsurance side, you know, as Frederick and Thomas and Alban mentioned, we're continuing to knock out some cat exposure. We're reducing our cat exposure, another round of cat exposure reduction, but we do expect the other lines to grow to offset that reduction. And with the rate and the offset, we expect to kind of be pretty close to flat on the reinsurance business.
Alban, higher yields and the discounting in IFRS 17?
So I wouldn't like to spoil the pleasure of the discussion we'll have in May when we present the 22 IFRS 17 numbers, but a few things. One, investment income stays the same for most asset classes under IFRS 17 compared to IFRS 4. The big difference is equity capital gains, which, as you will remember from our November presentation, will not go to P&L, would go directly to capital, to balance sheet. But you will have effectively the benefit of the discount on the 22 numbers. And since we're talking of IFRS 17, one or two things to add. One is we steered the 22 numbers to IFRS 4. Our PYDs, as you will see in the appendix, and we refer to that, are made of the excess reserves, and those excess reserves under IFRS 17 do not exist. So that will also create a difference compared to IFRS 4.
So we have time for one more person to ask, because you've always got more than one question. Let's go into the middle.
I forgot one thing, just to be clear, because I saw you raising your eyebrows on this. Investment income stays the same, but you have the unwind of reserves that I forgot that will come also in IFRS 17.
And so for the two people, Hadley and William, who still have got questions, we will make sure by the time you exit this building, your questions have been answered. Will.
Okay, I'll try and make it quick. Personal motor, it looks like it's performing exceptionally well relative to peers. Are you doing anything differently? Geographic mix, dispersion explanation? We hear lots of phrases like inflation loads being thrown around. Do you think you're already capturing that in attritional? Second one is just perhaps helpful to provide some colour on German, Swiss, January pricing renewals from personal lines and what you're currently pricing in UK motor as a year-on-year trend. You mentioned it's a challenging market. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. So, Antimo, these are two questions for you. You have the pleasure to answer the last two questions. The first one on personal motor. What are we doing differently? And since you are looking at many markets, you can also maybe give some examples of some concrete markets. And the second question was around German Swiss repricing. Nobody's better placed than you.
So, first, what we are doing better. So, it's clearly that we have a strong footprint in P&C retail special motor. We are working on different elements. The first is put a lot of innovation inside. I'll give a couple of examples. Second is also the relationship with car dealer, with tied agents, helps a lot to put, I would say, the retention rate very high. And then also the discipline and the process in the liquidation of the claims. We are working really fast and in a very good customer satisfaction manner. So this is the three level that we are working. And if I go to the innovation, so we are working a lot with new tools that an example is in Switzerland, Neumos. It's a startup that we have built with image recognition where we can, with after damage, we can really look at the damage, have really quick the answer is covered or not, and we can also organize very quick the repair, and we can also go to a settlement. And if you go to a settlement, normally what you are paying is 20% less. So that's a little bit the way that we are working. And in this way, what we are also doing is when the customer has one contract with us, we are trying to develop the customer to more contract because then the retention rates and it will increase. So this is about the P&C and motor business. The second question, please, again.
Was about Swiss and German renewal pricing.
Yeah. So in Swiss and German renewal prices, if I look to the inflation, is that we have seen that in Switzerland we didn't have inflation in the market, so in the claims. That we see that our price, we adapt the price very quick. We put new innovation product on the market, and this has helped us a lot to have good renewal in the P&C retail, but also in commercial line. And the second element in Germany is working also with adaption on the price, not one per year, but every month. And this has helped us a lot because we are doing price increase, price adaption every month, and this helps also to have a different system compared to our competitors, because our competitors, all the renewal comes at the end of the year, and the end in Germany are coming every month. So the attention for us is not all the portfolio should be renewed at the end of the year, but we have this a distribution between all the months on the year, and this has helped also a lot. So overall, I think technical capability on an underwriting, good relationship, innovation in the product, this has helped a lot to do more retention compared to our peers in the markets.
And Will, it also goes back, I think the secret goes back to our organizational model. because we are simpler, because we are focused, we have less priorities to look at, and we can really drill down. And in a period like this, where things are changing so quickly, having your eye on the ball very quickly, but also deciding the reaction very quickly, is absolutely key. And I think this is the secret behind the numbers. You see a very high fluidity in the team, very strong challenging and connection and quick reaction. And this is also the way we want to continue. I'm sorry that we have to interrupt here. I know we still have questions in the room, so you will get your answer before you leave the building. And I'm also sorry that if there were any questions on the webcast, so we'll make sure that you get your answer in writing. Thank you very much for having been here today. Thank you for asking questions, and we wish you now a great rest of your afternoon and evening. Thank you.